Members, if you will please indulge me for a moment, let me talk to those people who frankly you support. That's right, non-member. That member over there, the one that I'm pointing at, well, they're supporting you. They make it possible for you to hear this show on a daily basis. Come on, folks! For 50 cents a day, you can become a Majority Report member and you can keep this show going. Get off your duff. Pull yourself up by your bootstraps and give me money. Well, you know what I mean. Become a member at majority.fm today. It's 10 bucks a month. You get a piece of swag and you keep the show alive. Thank you, members, for your indulgence.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, April 20th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar, and this is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting, not quite live, from the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Ladies and gentlemen, it is my vacation week, but just because I am taking a well-deserved break, that doesn't mean that your hunger and desire for the Majority Report in any way wanes. And as such, here it is, folks, a fresh new piece of content. So sit back and enjoy. Okay, I'd like to welcome to the program Ellen Ruppel Schell. She is a professor at Boston University and author of Cheap, The High Cost of Discount Culture. We have a link to it on our blog at majority.fm, and also a longtime correspondent for The Atlantic Monthly. Welcome to the program, Ellen.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with now, the book came out in 2009, but you were quoted in a story I saw, and it reminded me of the book, about IKEA, because you examined IKEA and, in fact, the factory that was mentioned in this story. I spoke about it last week on the program. But just tell us a little bit of background about IKEA in general and about this factory in Danville, Virginia.
Well, actually, I went to Sweden to go to the original IKEA store, as well as to go to the headquarters of IKEA. IKEA, we all think of it as a Swedish company, but in fact, it's based now in Holland, in the Netherlands, for tax purposes. But their headquarters, that's technically their headquarters, still remain in Sweden. And so I went there. But in the course of writing Cheap, I of course discovered about the Danville plant, because it was so ironic that a European company was coming to the United States for several reasons to do manufacturing. We normally think of the United States outsourcing its manufacturing to developing countries, or to China, to Vietnam, to India. But here was a European company that was doing its manufacturing in one plant in Danville, Virginia. And so I talked to some of the folks who were working in that plant. And at the time, they were quite happy to have the job, because that area, which had a furniture-making industry but also a tobacco industry, was a little bit on the skids, and people there was a relatively high unemployment rate, and people were happy to get any job. But what I found was that their wages were far lower than they had been at previous factory jobs. So I recall one woman in particular, she'd been 20 years of experience working in a factory and making close to $17 an hour. Starting IKEA, she was making slightly over $11 an hour. But in the time that has transpired since I did that research, which is about 3 years ago, till today, the wages at that plant have declined still further to about $8 an hour for many of the factory workers, regardless of experience. So IKEA is able to manufacture at a very low cost goods that in Sweden they'd have to be paying workers about $17 an hour to manufacture. So as you can see, you know, IKEA, which we always think of as this green company or a company that does the right thing, to keep its low prices, and that's what my book is about, the high cost of discount culture, searches the globe, really, for low-cost labor. And they found it, ironically, here in the United States.
Now, in the case of IKEA, what would be, I mean, if they've actually lowered their pay over the past 3 years, what would account, I mean, if they're doing this presumably to keep their products cheap, what are the rising costs that have factored into this? I guess gasoline to transport these things or raw materials? They're doing anything they, I mean, is it, in other words, are they taking profits from this, or is it a function of just wanting to maintain their low prices?
It's an incredibly profitable company, and the founding director of IKEA is one of, it's not well known, but he is one of the wealthiest men in the world. He's always in the top 10 list. One year he even surpassed, as I recall, Bill Gates as
wow.
One of the wealthiest men in the world. So they do very, very well. In fact, IKEA in the last couple of years has done extremely well because they're perceived to be a low-priced purveyor of goods. And they're quite interested in profit, and they do quite a bit of profit taking. The Comprad family, is extraordinarily wealthy, they make no bones about it. To avoid paying taxes, the founding director lives now in Switzerland because Sweden would tax him, of course, quite heavily for the income that he has. So he's a tax refugee. So it is not the case that it's just rising costs that they're trying to mitigate, that they're trying to keep their labor costs down. It is a highly, highly profitable company.
And so it's also because they can get away with it. But it's also interesting. I mean, this is the point of your book in some ways, is that when we get cheap products, we end up paying for it in some other fashion. I mean, tell us another anecdote just in terms of shrimp, because that story I also remember quite well.
Oh, right. And when the book came out, that got quite a bit of play. People were very interested in that aspect. And, of course, the shrimp importing industry was quite angry about this. But shrimp, believe it or not, we eat more shrimp in the United States than we do tuna fish. It is a very cheap commodity. It used to be a delicacy.
Well, that's the thing, I still remember, right? Like when it was inappropriate for you to eat the shrimp before the company came because we had a limited amount of shrimp and, around the cocktail sauce, and it was a big deal to have the shrimp.
Absolutely. It was for, you know, special occasions, weddings for special occasions. It was a luxury food. And because of the domestication of shrimp, the farming of shrimp, the price went way down. This is in partly the case because of growing shrimp on the coast of Thailand. Thailand is almost a perfect location for growing shrimp for all sorts of reasons. Naturally, wild shrimp, but not satisfied with the haul there, they created pools where the shrimp could be farmed. You know, and so very intense food sources would be poured into these very large, huge pools on the coast. And very, very large numbers of shrimp would be grown in these pools in very, what I think many of us would think of as very unsanitary conditions. Antibiotics would be poured in to try and ward off infection. And as a consequence of this, the mangroves, which are very important for all sorts of reasons on the coast of Thailand, were eroded. The mangrove swamps were destroyed. And this is quite a catastrophic kind of occurrence on the coast of Thailand. The World Bank supported this originally. They thought this would be a good source of income for Thai farmers, but ultimately it became a good source of income for very few people. Immigrant labor was brought in to do the work and was exploited and abused. And as a consequence of this, we have very low price shrimp now in the United States, much lower than we once had when it's imported from Asia. Some controls, since I wrote the book, some controls have been put in. I was not only my own book, but many others also chimed in, and there's been quite a bit of protest about this. So there's some efforts being made, and I haven't been back to Thailand to see for myself how it's going, but it, certainly at the time, it was pretty horrifying.
Wow. And so the implications, of course, are what it does environmentally, what it does in terms of labor, and I guess also in terms of our health to a certain extent, because the shrimp that we're eating today may not necessarily be of the same quality in terms of antibiotics and whatnot as the shrimp that we ate 20 years ago.
Oh, absolutely. And I think people who've had shrimp right off the Gulf Coast, naturally caught, and compare it with what you get frozen from the Far East, oftentimes, especially the farm shrimp, will tell you that it tastes completely different. You know, so the thing that we used to think of as a luxury food, which was really, you know, delicious, is pretty hard to come by these days. And so we've kind of traded off low price and quantity. You know, the endless shrimp bowl. Doing this chapter, I actually, you know, talked to some folks, you know, looked at these low-cost restaurants that offer endless shrimp, and one waiter said, you know, I once served 200 shrimp to one customer for $15.99. You know, he served them 200 shrimp. I can't imagine how anyone could eat that much. But it was all, you know, it was all you could eat. And so you've taken a food that when you were a young guy, you know, your parents, your mother told you, lay off the shrimp until the company comes, and now it's all you can eat. Just pile it on. It's just commodified. And, you know, because we demand these very low-priced goods, we have what economists call externalities. There are other costs involved that we don't see at the checkout counter. Well, but as I argue in the book, it's kind of come back to bite us with in terms of our jobs and labor and other things here in the U.S.
Well, let's talk about that. I mean, I guess the IKEA is a pretty good example to some extent in that we have this demand for cheap furniture, but what happens is it actually ends up driving down wages significantly. Give me just more examples of that, because I think there's a sense, you know, you go into Walmart and everything's cheaper there, and if you're poor, or you're frankly at this point, you know, middle class, or you know, we have 50% of the country that makes you know, $30,000 or less or something, your dollar goes further at Walmart. I mean, isn't that the narrative that we're told?
Well, that is the narrative, of course, and that's what we're told. But I think the American people, as you mentioned, the book's been out now for a couple of years, and I've given talks all over the country as well as in Europe, and I can tell you that a lot of middle class and working people especially feel ripped off by low cost, not only because their jobs have taken a beating and they're expected to work for next to nothing, and their jobs are insecure and they have, you know, no control over their future and all these side effects, but because the goods themselves are questionable. I mean, just yesterday I was giving a talk, and a young woman said that she'd really given up on buying the junky clothes at H&M after she learned from her grandmother that her grandmother used to have a sweater and would actually keep it for 15 years. And she thought this was amazing that someone could have something that would last that long when she was buying something at a discount store, wearing it twice and seeing it shrink or losing its shape. and having to basically throw it away or you know, give it away. And so, in fact, here's a little known fact. Americans buy, on average, one article of clothing every 4 to 5 days. Now, that's a stunning figure. We buy stuff all the time. So Europeans don't buy nearly as much, and the quality is higher. And because they don't expect to throw things away nearly as quickly, because they repair things when they buy them, they have a different system. Not every, you know, certainly discounting has taken off in Europe as well, but not to the extent, certainly, that it has in the United States. So we have this constant churning of goods and the concentration of profits in very few hands.
And the fact is that the savings that we might enjoy in terms of buying cheap goods and whatnot is not that big of our budgets, is it? I mean, it seems to me that the biggest things that eat up budgets for Americans are things like rent, food, gas prices now, and health care. So the savings on these goods is, at the end of the day, is pretty minimal, and the implications of how it is so cheap end up costing us in other areas.
Oh, that is so true. I mean, you hit the nail on the head there, for sure. The things that really cost us in the United States are health care, education, transportation, and housing. Food is actually relatively cheap in the United States, even with the increased cost recently. But those other things, things we cannot control, we can't control the cost of gasoline. We can't control the cost of our health care, which is completely out of control. We all know the front page of the New York Times today talked about how many students are laden with university debt and really burdened with that debt. These are the things that are really costing us. The fact that we can get tube socks or T-shirts, five for, you know, $10, is not really helping us with our really serious costs. And in a way, it's a perfect situation for corporate interests to say, well, go, look, have fun. Go buy, you know, buy stuff. Buy cheap toys from China, cheap T-shirts from Vietnam. Go and have fun. Spend your money. That's your freedom, you know, at the same time saying, well, we won't pay you a decent wage. We won't allow you to join a union. We'll discourage you from joining unions. Your health care costs are through the roof. Well, that's too bad. Go and have fun at a discount store. To me, I mean, that's part of the reason that motivated me to write the book. I find that absolutely infuriating and patronizing and insulting to the American people. I mean, we have...
And it's costing us.
They're not aligned with that.
I mean, for instance, Walmart, they're offloading a lot of their medical costs basically on the government in one shape or another. Society is ending up picking up these tabs for this stuff, and we're getting paid back with low-cost, low-quality goods is essentially the way that it works.
Exactly. They very much offload their costs, healthcare. You know, at one point, many people have reported who've worked for Walmart that when they sign the papers, Walmart tells them how they can get health care from the state.
Right.
Because they, you know, they can't afford to pay for it, and Walmart doesn't cover it. I think the vast majority of Walmart's employees are part-time, so they're not eligible for any health insurance that they have, and the health insurance that they do have is costly, and most don't avail themselves of it. So yes, it's not just Walmart, as you can see, you know, by the news, the article you mentioned. It's also IKEA. It's many low-cost purveyors. The idea that we are consumers, right, but not really citizens. You know, that's what's happened.
When did this? Was it always the case? I mean, was there a time where the country moved in this direction, where the balance? I mean, because I know, for instance, in the early 70s, the prices of food dropped fairly significantly because we started to subsidize corn, and corn ended up replacing all sorts of different ingredients in our food, and you know, including the food itself on some level. You know, so much of what we eat is filler. But it just made it cheaper to eat this now, you know, what you could call a food product as opposed to actually food. It brought the prices down on food, but at the end of the day, we end up paying for this stuff again because of diabetes that's rampant and because of all the other implications, including obviously the subsidies. But was there a time where our society changed to this more sort of disposable culture?
Oh, absolutely. And first you have to remember that in the Depression, just after the Depression, the beginning of the Depression, my dates might be not exactly right, but in the 1930s, there was a big concern about what folks were calling predatory pricing, pricing that was so low that it would put smaller merchants out of business. And there was a big campaign in the United States to outlaw predatory pricing, and there were laws enacted to outlaw predatory pricing. All these were forgotten in the build-up in the 70s. We no longer have these laws, or are they enforced? So the whole idea of predatory pricing is out the window. The lower the price, the better, as far as we're concerned today. This is not the way it was in the 1930s when we were concerned about the Depression. Certainly what's made possible these very low prices, I mean, it's no secret, technology-powered globalization. Right, so we have the internet. We can, you know, it's not just manufactured goods, but it's also knowledge work that can be outsourced. And there's a giant labor arbitrage, as they call it, that, you know, going to the lowest bidder all over the globe. So wherever you can make the goods as cheaply as possible, or even in some cases increasingly, knowledge work, where it can be done as cheaply as possible. And oftentimes where it's done as cheaply as possible is outside the rule of law. You know, it's in countries where there are no unions, mm-hmm. like in China, which I visited for the book. There's only one union, that's a government union, and you know what that means. So it's a good place to do manufacturing because there are no environmental rules, there are very few labor laws are not enforced. It's a great place to do business if you want to make a profit. It's not a great place, not a great way to keep Americans employed. And yet we're told, we need those low prices. Isn't that a good deal? And don't we all deserve to pay less? You know,
was there a turning point? Was there something that, was this a concerted effort, or is it just sort of like, it sort of naturally evolved this way?
You know, I think, you know, in the book I talk about the rise of consumer culture, and you know, it was through, you know, there's a long history that I get into with advertising and
right.
The rise of consumerism in the United States, which is perfectly fine until we realize that we're consuming things that we're not making anymore.
Right.
Right? We don't make televisions anymore in the United States. It was a nice balance when we were consuming things that were made in the United States. But now we're told just to consume things made in other countries and brought back to us. And those good jobs are gone. So we're told to consume and consume and consume, increase our debt and credit card debt and other kinds of debt, just keep going, and you can see, you know, what's happened as a result of all this. So this was really became, since the 1970s, this has become more and more powerful. And you should understand that for the middle class, wages and benefits have basically stagnated since
right.
the 1970s.
Right.
So, you know, we've traded off. We've traded off wages and job stability and security for low-priced consumer goods.
And finally, do you think this is sustainable? I mean, I obviously there are, you know, we're dealing with these externalities, and it may come to a head in this country, but I'm not exactly sure how it would. Aside from the idea of, like, let's say, peak oil, making the capacity for these corporations to make this stuff with the slave labor in China and ship it over here and drive it all around the country, or, you know, Walmart to have their factory on wheels. Aside from that, is the system vulnerable in any way?
Well, I think it showed its vulnerability with our current economic downturn. I think, you know, I hate to say this, part of the success of the book was because it came at the time of the economic downturn. Mm-hmm. And some people asked me how I knew how to time it like that. I said, I did not predict this. I had no way of knowing it. But this is, you know, certainly the employment crisis. And we all know that the 8.8% so-called unemployment numbers are much, much higher than folks are claiming. the unemployment crisis can be tied directly to this. You know, if we were willing to pay a little bit more, there would be more jobs available up and down the supply chain in every industry. And because we wring out as much cost as we possibly can, the easiest way for producers to cut costs is to cut labor costs. They're going to need just as much, you know, raw material to make those pencils, but they can get away with less labor, or they can outsource the labor. So that is the way to make profits. As well, you know, we allow unlimited profit-taking here in the United States. So, you know, even if profit is to be made, it can be made by very, very few. That's not the case in countries like, for example, Sweden, right? Which is why IKEA does its business here now in the United States, in Danville, and elsewhere around the globe. We allow those things to happen, and, of course, the jobs have been pushed down and out. And so that, you know, to my mind, the jobs crisis, which I think is really just about one of the most important problems we have in the U.S., if not the most important problem, is a direct consequence of this. And I think some people are getting pushing back on this. I think there is a gathering awareness of this. And hopefully, certainly since I did the book, I've heard a lot of people anecdotally saying, you know what, I've figured this out. I'm going to stop shopping like this, because it's costing me way too much.
Alan Ruppelschell, the author of Cheap, The High Cost of Discount Culture, thanks so much for joining us on the program.
Thank you. I'm going to get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. Finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. I guess I'm where the choice is made, for the option where you don't get paid, for the rope that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive.